from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net bonus podcast. My name is Jacob Fortag.
I'm Ryan Harkness.
And we are not coming to you live. We're coming to you definitely not live.
Oh, this is the first show since the live show, isn't it?
Exactly. And this because this is October and we decided that on October we're going to just push really hard and make for October all the bonus shows for free. Everybody's listening to the bonus show right now. So this is a bonus show that people are having. They're going to be so sick of us. By the end of the month, they're going to be like, I'm sick of you guys. You talk all the time. Blah. Or maybe not.
Maybe they'll be enticed to subscribe with us. For how much is it, Jacob?
It's for $20 a year. But we'll talk about that later on in the show. Speaking of new listeners, hopefully we have some new listeners that were tuning in because they heard of us at the Atheist Conference. We'd like to say hello to anybody else who's actually listening to us for the first time.
Hey, well, and then there's the gigantic people who are just here to hear Susan Jacoby, and they're like, what are these guys doing?
Talking? Yeah, exactly. It's like, who are these douchebags? Why do I have to listen to them? Is this going to be good? Well, the Susan Jacoby interview that's going to follow very shortly after our little introduction to it is about an hour long, so I hope you guys are bored.
Get a cup of hot chocolate, settle into a comfortable chair.
You know, a lot of people are actually probably listening to this while driving, so they're like, man, I wish I was home with a cup of hot cocoa in a warm chair instead of this freezing-ass truck or whatever else.
Or on the bus.
Or on the bus, yeah. Oh, that really sucks, eh? Hey, yeah, person on the bus, you smell anybody that fucking needs a shower? I bet. I fucking bet. There's always one dude on the bus that needs a shower, isn't there? And you're like, why did you come on the bus, man?
I feel that dude. I've been him before.
I have been him for a whole year. When I used to work with my uncle digging holes, all right, it was an hour and a half bus trek every fucking day, and I was a smelly guy coming back. There was so little you could do. It was so horrible. I was like a homeless man. It's just like that whole year where you hope that your brain will get to a point where it forgets how embarrassed you were for that long. But fuck, the money was good, son. So good. You couldn't say no. It's like if a person drove over to your house with a truckload of money and says all you need to do is be the smelly guy on the bus, would you do it?
Then you'll be the smelly guy.
Yeah, you'll do it, man. Fucking money overrides your common sense, I think, to some degree, right? Am I right? If I show up with a fucking briefcase full of money and I just tell you to do something, I don't know what that thing is, but I tell you just do it because I have a briefcase full of money, odds are you'd probably do it, man. You'd probably do it.
I'm worried about the sexual component of this discussion.
I'm not going there. I mean, if you wanted to go there, I would just talk about showing up with a briefcase full of money. You're the one who started thinking about sex. So what does that say about you, huh? What do you think I would do with money, huh? Proposition people that don't want to have sex with me to have sex with me? No, I don't think so. I think you can spend your money better than that. Unless that's your kink, then I'm saying you're pretty fucked up. Well, we're going to move on to the interview. So in case that you, the beginning seems kind of weird to you guys, it's actually because it was an acceptance speech that she made because she won the Richard Dawkins award at the conference. Unfortunately, they weren't able to actually play my interview due to technical difficulties. So you get to hear it all in its entirety. It is fucking 1 hour, so strap in, boys and girls. You're about to go on a journey. All right, without further ado, my interview with Susan Jacoby.
Okay. First, I would like to say how honored I am to have been selected as the recipient of your Richard Dawkins Award this year, and how very much I regret not being in Montreal to accept this award personally. I'm recovering from a knee surgery that I knew was coming, but I made the mistake of accepting my doctor's overly optimistic estimate of how soon it would be reasonably comfortable, as comfortable as it gets these days anyway, to travel on planes. Also, I'm the program director for the Center for Inquiry branch in New York City, And this Thursday, we have the biggest event of our year coming up, presenting Sam Harris talking about his new book, The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values. And by the way, if any of you are going to be in New York this Thursday, I urge you to visit our website, Google Center for Inquiry, New York City, for more information. Now, Sam Harris's speech conflicts directly with another event I can't attend, which is the annual Center for Inquiry Transnational Convention in Los Angeles. Now, there is a point here beyond the fact that I have a sore knee and am personally overscheduled. Atheists and freethinkers tend to be overscheduled these days. There was a time not very long ago when I think many of us would have laughed at the idea that there would be three major events in the space of 1 week with nationally and internationally respected speakers on the subject of reason and the threat that unreason poses to our world. I think we can take this as an important measure of the growing strength of our movement and its potential. Even at a time when the strength of the forces of unreason, from places where women's faces are scarred with acid for the crime of wanting an education, to an ancient cathedral in London where the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church equates drawing and quartering of religious martyrs in the 16th century with the, quote, ridicule, unquote, that wounds the Vatican today. As a secularist, I call that progress. So I accept your word with real gratitude and hope you'll enjoy the interview which follows. Thank you.
All right. That was very nice, a very well-prepared speech. I can see now why I enjoyed your book so thoroughly. Now, I did have some general questions. I mean, about the fact that you are overbooked, as you said before. Did you really ever imagine that such a thing was possible? I mean, I think it's incredible that in just such a short time, we're already this busy.
Well, that's right. That's the point I was making in accepting the award. Really, it is absolutely amazing that, and by the way, that speech, I know you could edit this out, so it's not a problem. That speech is cognizant of the fact that it's being delivered on October 1st. In other words, the dates I talk about are, you know, in other words, it's going to be delivered October 1st at this convention.
Right.
I never thought it was possible that that Richard Dawkins would be speaking in one place on the same night that Sam Harris is speaking in another, and that events like this would be so thick that they would conflict within the space of a week. We've got three gatherings of free thinkers and atheists and secularists of all kinds, major gatherings in Montreal, New York, and Los Angeles. That's very different than things were only 10 years ago.
Well, that leads me, though, to this question. I was wondering if you had given this any thought. There is, I feel, at least to some degree, perhaps it's only perception, but hopefully you can clarify, there seems to be much stronger pushback, from the part of religionists, we'll call them. And do you think that's a direct consequence of atheists and free thinkers really coming out and being more vocal? Like, are we watching the reverberations of the religious right try to fight back against us? And can we expect that to grow?
Oh, I think so. It's not as though, particularly now talking about America, obviously some people in this convention are going to be from places which are much more secular than America already, one of them being Canada itself. However, in America, I am sure that we can expect a lot more pushback. And not only that, it's not just a result of the heightened secular, humanist, free thought, atheist activity in the last 10 years, which in some ways was really a response to the extremes of the Bush administration. I think that, you know, that's not just a coincidence that we began to hear a lot more from atheists after the election of George W. Bush, because it really was, his election was a big victory for the religious right, although the religious right has gotten crazier. Now, one of the things that has happened, which I do think is a consequence of the more open activity on the part of freethinkers, is that the religious right has been able to elevate its long-held stance that it's victimized, that secularists have won, right, that textbooks in schools are all secular and that they give the secular version of history. and that they ignore religion. And so that every time an atheist writes a book, although in fact the books of the religious right, I hate to say, far outsell the books of Richard Harris, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, me, Dan Dennett, every free thought or atheist writer you can think of imaginable, they really outsell us. But I think that the fact that more people are giving an ear to the kinds of things that atheists and freethinkers have been saying for a long time, it sort of aids in this narrative of victimization, which they present. Certainly in American politics, it's a huge theme.
Well, do you think that there's any, I mean, I don't know if you had heard or seen the speech by Phil Plait about don't be a dick, that there he had come forward and said that basically he thought that there was a profusion of venom and anger and just generally hate spewing that was causing, I suppose, us to lose the battle for the hearts and minds of people right in the middle. Do you think there's some justification to that, or is that really more of a perhaps just us being almost overly sensitive about the way that we present our message, or at least our viewpoints, let's say?
Look, there is a whole range of thinking among atheists. One of the reasons that atheists are not a religion is that Richard Dawkins is not the Pope, and I am not required to receive a Richard Dawkins Award to agree with every line that Richard Dawkins has written. We don't have a group of doctrines which are decided on by some people in the Vatican. So I think there is a whole range of position, and one of the things, for instance, in which I differ from my colleagues, certainly I differ from Sam Harris on this, is that I don't think moderate religion is the greatest enemy of freedom and free thought. I think if the religious world were made up of Unitarians and Reformed Jews, we wouldn't be having a lot of the discussions we're having. Where the real problem with religion is for me as a citizen, as opposed to whatever I might think about anybody's religion, is when it tries to intrude on public life and impose its values on public life. And in that respect, no, I don't think the so-called moderate religions are a threat at all. I think the religion that's the real enemy of freedom, whether we're talking about radical Islam or about the Texas School Board, which has just written Thomas Jefferson out of the history of world revolutionary writers, the real threat is when religion tries to impose its values on the rest of us.
Well, if I recall correctly,
and I don't think that has a lot to do with the way atheists or freethinkers present themselves.
Right.
In other words, I think for those kind of people who basically want to impose their religion on everyone, it doesn't matter whether you make nice with moderate religion or not, because as far as they're concerned, by the way, an Anglican church that ordains a gay bishop or somebody who believes in gay marriage or in contraception is just as bad as an atheist.
Now, you've written a lot about, I guess, what you would consider to be an age of unreason, if I can quote your books. And you talk a lot, I guess, about how there's been a degradation in, I guess, if we could put it, in education, culture, you know, all the things that you would say a civilized society is probably strives towards. Do you think that this is continuing? Is this trend, like, since you've written the book, has this gotten worse? Has it improved? Where are we now?
Unfortunately, the name of the book is The Age of American Unreason.
Right.
Obviously, such a book could be written about a lot of different countries, though, in a
definitely,
different way.
Definitely.
As far as America goes, I think things have gotten worse. They have gotten worse than I would have imagined. When I wrote that book, I was thinking more of structural things like the immense influence of the internet, which can be an influence for good, but is also a very big influence for bad in the terms of just spreading crackpot ideas faster than they've ever been able to be spread in the history of the human race. But I think things are worse now. It is pretty clear now to me, as far as America is concerned, that when Barack Obama was elected, and this is true whether you agree with all of his political policies or not, he was a reasonable man. He is a reasonable man. And this is true whatever personal disappointments people may have in him as a liberal or a conservative. And the normal thing is, when somebody gets elected, is that people say, oh, well, hell, I don't want him to be president, but he's the president. But that hasn't happened this time, and I think what I estimated, and a lot of Americans who voted for Obama underestimated, was the real depth of hatred on the part of those who voted against him. This is not a normal situation when you have over 20% of the American population, most of them Republicans, actually think that the president is not an American citizen. This is not any kind of a normal situation. Now, whether they really believe this or not is actually not the point. It's the narrative of unreason, which is he's not one of us, so he's not legitimate. Well, this is a classic narrative of anti-rationalism. And it's true that in American history, and not just in American history, this kind of thing so often shows up at times of economic stress, which, of course, we're all experiencing in many parts of the world, and certainly the anti-immigrant reactions in Europe are part of that as well. You know, when I read the stories every day about the Roma being driven from one country to another, what is that but irrational racism, you know, based on economic unease about the European Union. So that has its parallel in America. But I think the level of discourse in American public life now, which I thought would really rise under Obama, it's now lower.
Well, I've always wondered this, and perhaps you can.
It's worse today than it was when that book was published, which I really did not expect.
Well, unfortunately, it's like a tide, you know, it's a force of nature, it seems. Do you think that...
It's also a force of money, financing it.
Well, that's definitely a part of it. Do you believe that America, because it is so influential and powerful, do you think that its citizens have a responsibility to be even more educated rather than less educated? Because I think honestly, in my opinion, anyone who would consider their country to be number one and be allowed to dictate the policies of other nations, I'm like, you better be fucking educated to a high degree. Do you think that maybe...
Well, America, first of all, I don't know about the responsibility of America. The
Are
fact
you sure?
The fact is, educationally, America is not number one. America, by any measure of educational achievement, America is far behind most of the other developed countries in the West and in Asia, including Canada, Japan, Korea, France, Germany, Sweden, Denmark. We don't do as well. There are a lot of reasons for that, but the failures of our educational system, and America once did lead the world in public education, had broader public education long before educational opportunities were extended to large numbers of people in Europe, on the European continent, and Asia. But America is in a real pickle educationally, and this feeds into the anti-rationalism. And I have to say that one of the big problems in America today, right now, is I'm watching with great disturbance. The fact is that a lot of very rich, achievers, people who've made a huge amount of money in computers and software, from Bill Gates being foremost among them, are putting money into public schools in a way that enables them to exert some control over them. There, a lot of this is a kind of the idea that half privatizing public schools is what's going to save them. Well, I am actually very, very disturbed at seeing this idea that money, even when it comes from people I respect, used privately is what's going to save the American schools.
Well, I think there was a famous Simpsons episode where in the future they're like, if you have one Pepsi and someone gives you another Pepsi, how many Pepsis do you have? And Ralph, you know, lifts up his hand and says, Pepsi, partial credit.
Well, I don't think that privatization has proved to be successful at anything. And I hope, you know, I think we're embarking on a really vast experiment. I think that the way to fix American public schools, it's very simple. It has to do with the way teachers are trained and selected in places like Japan and France. It is no easier. Again, there's a very anti-labor, anti-union psychology, and we're sort of getting off the point here. But the idea that bad teachers and the ability to fire them is the paramount way to fix American public schools. It's very much free market. The fact is, it's much harder to fire a teacher in France or Japan than it is in the United States. The difference is it's hard to get into the teaching profession in the first place. They select the best students for teacher training programs, and they pay them accordingly. In this respect, I do agree with the free market. Everybody says you can't throw money at problems. If you train a teacher the way they do in France and Japan, and this is something that I agree with conservatives about, by the way, and if you pay them so that a starting teacher gets as much money as a starting MBA holder, you're going to have better teachers. Right now, anybody who wants a decent living does not go into teaching in America.
Well, I've talked to a lot of even people that listen to the show that our teachers, one in particular, has to teach at a Christian school because there's no other options. Like and he's paid very little, so much so that I think that he hasn't even yet become a member of the bonus show that I provide for like $20 a year. He's like, I can't afford it. The one thing I wanted to ask you, and I guess maybe you can help with this. I'm not an American. I live up in Canada, but I do watch quite a bit of your news. Can you try to explain to me or any of the other fans that are not American, can you explain to me what exactly the Tea Party is all about? Because I still don't really understand fundamentally why they continue to exist and grow. Like, what is going on?
Of course you don't understand. You're Canadian. The Tea Party is the rich result of the kind of ignorance I was talking about. It's a mistake. One thing, the mainstream American media, and this has been picked up around the world, and I imagine this is the way a lot of the CBC people explain it to you up in Canada, is that it's a response to tough economic times and the feeling that nothing is being done for the middle class. It is much more than that. It's also what you hear at the Tea Party rallies over and over again is we've got to take our country back. Now, that is not about money, and it's not about what's being done to the middle class. It's about an anti-rational stew, a feeling that the country is being taken over by people who are not one of us, people who are racially mixed, people who may not be Christians or their kind of Christians, people who are too educated, and certainly the narrative that Obama is an elitist who just doesn't know anything about ordinary people, and being taken over by people who aren't really Americans because they mostly grew up in Hawaii. Then, and here is the religious thing, then you add the anti-Muslim thing, which exists strongly in every country. As far as I'm concerned, nobody needs to lecture Americans about anti-Islam.
Seriously.
You know, if I hear anybody in Germany or France, you know, telling me how anti-Islamic Americans are, forget it. You're a lot better off being a Muslim American in America than you are in France or in England or in Germany.
No, there's definitely a lot of fear-mongering going over in Europe.
But there's a lot of fear-mongering going on, and every time, only today, I pick up the New York Times and I find out the Texas Board of Education, the same board that said Thomas Jefferson is not one of the revolutionary writers, and one of the people they substituted for him in the textbook, Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence. one of the people who substituted for him, this should appreciate, the people at the atheist convention should appreciate this, was Thomas Aquinas. That great 13th century progressive revolutionary writer, Thomas Aquinas. Now, today I pick up the paper, the same Board of Education is now calling out the nation's textbook publishers for their pro-Islamic views. I don't know what those could be, since when you look at a world history textbook that most American high school students study, you hardly learn anything about the rest of the world in it. I don't know where this stuff about it having a pro-Islamic bias was. My guess is that before 9/11, most American high school students didn't even have any idea what a Muslim was.
Well, there's a chance that perhaps they want to take the word arithmetic because it does have Arabic roots, you know. That's kind of scary.
Yes. but arithmetic is also, look, one of the points I make about ignorance being so key to the Tea Party, which you asked about, is this. We are now in America in the debate over whether Bush's tax cuts are going to be continued or allowed to expire. Bush's tax cuts, and what the Tea Party says is, what, how terrible to raise taxes. Bush's tax cuts basically only benefited families making over $250,000 a year. The average American family got nothing from the Bush tax cuts. The median American family income is now around $64,000 a year. Whether the tax cuts continue or expire is in no way relevant to the American middle class. But the Tea Party people say it is. And look, if you're number 15th out of 16 developed countries in ordinary arithmetic, then when somebody says to you these tax cuts only benefit the top 2% of earners, you don't really know what they mean, because you have to know what the top 2% means to have a concept of what anybody trying to explain it is talking about.
Well, even if there is that comprehension of numbers, I've often heard people Tea Partiers talking about, well, the people who work for that money deserve it, it's theirs, and the government should be taken away. So they may even be aware that they're not receiving any benefits, but I think that in general, the Tea Party seems to have the ability through this irrationality to work against their own interests. I mean, what is it that they want to do? They want to repeal any health care that's been added so far. They want to take away all social programs because they say that they're a problem. They like say goodbye to ACOR and say goodbye to all these things. But most of the people who go to these rallies would be the ones that would be recipients of all of these things. You're like,
yeah, but it is ignorance, though. I assure you that a lot of them really don't understand. They don't understand what the graduated income tax is. They don't understand that they haven't been getting any tax cuts themselves. It's always the number of people who, if you said to the, who really believe that every billionaire should be able to keep every cent that he makes, I suspect would be quite small. The fact is, when you talk about the politics, Tea Party is based on three things: ignorance, religious fundamentalism, which is just a subspecies of ignorance, and class resentment and envy. They look at Barack Obama, a well-spoken graduate of Harvard, and they look at him and he's an elitist, and by the way, he's an elitist who also isn't white. He's gotten all these benefits. One of the things in the scurrilous literature that's around, of course, is that Barack Obama benefited from affirmative action. He didn't. I mean, Barack Obama did get scholarships because he earned them by having great grades. But class resentment plays, and it's across with racial resentment, plays a very big role. And then you have the big role of religion and the anti-Muslim business and the ability to create a script that says Obama is a Muslim.
How much would you say bigotry is veiled or camouflage? Like, take for instance Christine O'Donnell, the new little rising star, being supported by the Tea Party, who's saying, well, we would like to make homosexual sex illegal. When at what point is it where the bigotry of these people is becoming exposed? Like, is it just, are people still believing that they're not being bigoted by their views, they're just being fair-minded? Like, are they blind to their own bigotry?
It's hard to say, but there's something else even more than, I mean, I don't think you need to, you know, when I walked past on the corner, a bunch of Tea Partiers and saw the signs, this is a long time ago now, of Obama with a Hitler mustache, which they very, very, at their rally, they very carefully kept those signs away. But, I mean, I felt really sick. And one of the things, the American media has not been doing a very good job. All of the representatives of the media, really, they don't want to admit how much of a part of this racism really is. So they attribute it to almost anything but racism. All I can say is that if Barack Obama were white, there would be people who hated him, I suppose. But the truth is, his policies are really no different from Bill Clinton's. The fact that he's black is just very closely it's the core, and that he has a strange name, Muslim name, and that his father was born into a Muslim family in Africa. These things are very important.
Well, they definitely seem to have some effect. Let's just say that, put that mildly. On the rhetoric of the Tea Partiers. I want to move away from the Tea Party for 5 seconds.
Yes, yeah, so we should move to religion.
there was something that I wanted to talk about in your book in terms of junk thought in general, and this is something that I was, when I read in your book, and when you were talking about vaccinations and the mistrust of science, and again, when you said that things were worse, that was one of the things that I was thinking. I was like, well, everything that you were writing about in terms of people being distrustful of vaccines and medical science has itself also gotten much worse. You think about like cases of rubella popping up in England and in all these other countries, and it's upper, you know, like middle class families that are starting to have these kinds of.
Yes, actually, England was the home of the anti-vaccination movement. An article which has now been exposed, an article printed in Nature magazine, is completely fraudulent science, and the physician who falsified his experiments has been drummed out of the British Medical Association. Nevertheless, it started in England.
Well, that was Andrew Wakefield's Lancet article about the rubella, the MMR vaccine having a
leak in autism. It turned out to be based on an entirely fraudulent experiment.
It wasn't just that. I remember that he was being paid by the lawyers that were setting up a mass lawsuit, and at the same time, he was trying to develop his own vaccine. I mean, the dirt on this guy, like, it's so clear and obvious what he was trying to do, but at the same time, like, he drums up and creates this movement, and now we're, like, you know, in America, I think that pretty much Jenny McCarthy is probably the loudest celebrities, I'm assuming.
In America, the anti-vaccination movement has two components. One of them are anti-government people who simply don't think that the government should be able to make you do anything, including vaccinate your children before they go to school.
Right.
And then on the left, there is, as I've often said, junk thought is not just a phenomenon of the right.
Definitely.
On the left, a lot of the anti-vaccination movement is the old, you know, you can't trust a doctor, they're all lying to you, the natural way, well, yeah, the natural way was for people to die before the age of 40. The natural way, I am just old enough that I remember when the salt polio vaccine came in. I was 9 years old. We lined up to get it. And I remember before the salt polio vaccine and after. Before, our parents were in a constant state of terror. We couldn't go to swimming pools. No one under the age of 50 today has ever experienced this. We couldn't go to swimming pools in the summer because you might get polio. And in fact, it was true. The vaccine, the polio virus was easily transmitted in water and in air. So, and your parents were terrified. Anytime you got a stomach ache or a headache in the summer, there was real fear and terror. And after that, I mean, it's one of the greatest victories of modern medicine ever. Within 2 years, nearly 80% of the population in America had been vaccinated. And, you know, by the time I was 12 years old, there was no more fear of polio. It was just overnight.
Well, do you think that it's even possible that perhaps we're so unaccustomed to the types of tragedies that our ancestors would just call their daily routine, you know, like when our ancestors only a few hundred years ago had to deal with, well, if you have kids, definitely one of them will die.
Yeah,
regardless
of
how much you care about him or her.
Course.
And now this isn't happening. People aren't acclimatized to this kind of reality, and they're taken for granted. I think their whole argument is like, well, it's done for. We can stop inoculating now, and it's never going to come back.
Yeah, and it's and the low level of scientific literacy makes it possible for people to think that.
What do you think is in terms of say rationality or education, what do you think is the solution to all of this ignorance? Like, what do you present as, here's what we can do to try to turn back that tide?
I hate it when people ask that.
You can say I don't know, and that would be a fair answer.
I hate it when people ask that. in all books like mine, publishers long for you to have something at the end that offers something optimistic.
The happy ending.
The happy ending. Well, I think it is possible to do something about the level of public education. As I outlined earlier, I think it is possible to train teachers better and pay them a lot more and have a system in which only the best people get into the teaching profession, so you don't have to worry about firing the worst ones later on, but they don't get into it.
Right.
I do believe, however much a minority we may still be and are, I do think that that even though some people get mad, I think that atheists are making a big contribution to this. I think that they are making a contribution to rational discourse, and I think, you know, some of it gets through. Sam Harris has a new book just coming out, being published in October, called The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values. Well, I would have added a help to it. I don't think science can determine human values. But the point he is making is that, you know, this idea that religion, quote, has domain over values and science has domain over the physical world is ridiculous. These two things overlap all of the time. And what Sam is saying is that science should have a say in ethical values. And I agree with that, and I think that I think that this discourse is valuable, even though the majority of people don't agree with it. The majority of people didn't agree that the Earth revolved around the sun 500 years ago either. You don't suddenly change people's minds with a book or three books or four books or five books. But it's not. We're certainly not at any point where it's getting easier. And religion, especially fundamentalist religion, is one of the major sources of anti-rationalism in the world. It's not the only one. But of course it's related. It's related to all of the other things that are wrong. I mean, look, you look at societies, for instance, in which religion subjugates women,
right,
in which women cannot get an education, they're not allowed to earn a living, they're not allowed to have any control over their sexual lives. These are also the poorest societies in the world. Therefore, how can you say, this is here, science determines human values? I agree totally with Sam Harris that if the result is the poorest society in the world, then there's got to be something wrong with the society. And the idea that religion should determine what is moral within a given society in an entirely relativist way, I think, you know, I don't care whether you're talking about in the mountains of Afghanistan or in New York City. Most people would like to have enough to eat. Most people would like to be able to look up and see the sky. Most people, if they were exposed to anything else, wouldn't want to go around in a burqa with 10 yards of fabric preventing them from moving their arms and their legs. To me, moral relativism, which secularists have been accused of, I do think that there are values which are universal, and I don't care one whit if somebody's religion tells them the right way to live is by keeping women in the house and in burqas. Or what the Hindu religion taught for a long time was that the right thing to do was burn widows on their husband's funeral pyres. Big deal. It's wrong.
Well, we wouldn't, you know, I think it's kind of funny that any time we get accused of say, being moral relativists because we don't have a, let's say, a dogmatic view of moralism, I think it's kind of an interesting accusation because it assumes that when you have a variety in your own ethical discourse, that it's automatically going to lead to poor morality. That's what strikes me as odd. I'm like, you think that having a conversation about morality will lead to immorality.
Right. When you talk about that religion should have domain over values, nobody really means that. What they mean is their religion should domain over values. Because the truth is the world's religions uphold very different human values. So we don't mean, in other words, what I'm saying is Stephen Jay Gould was very wrong in his non-overlapping magisteria theory. What people mean when they say science has nothing to tell us about values, only religion can do that, is they mean my religion.
Well, I also quite love this idea that they always say that old pogrom of saying, well, science answers the why, the what, but religion offers the why. And I always thought, well, you can give me a why if you just make it up. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. It's easy to just say why. Oh, well, the sky raises because God desires it. This is why.
Right.
I can tell you exactly why. There is no why.
As the old 1950s song goes, every time I hear a newborn baby cry or touch a leaf or see the sky, then I know why I believe. It's nonsense.
Well, I think it's just one of those things, and I think religious people are definitely they may not be aware of this, but they do this quite a bit, is that they will begin to repeat something and feel as though the more it gets repeated, the truer it becomes, just because it now becomes, you know.
Well, but like that, you know, that's true of all sorts of ideologies. You know, it's the big lie or the big con. The more you say it, of course, the more it seems to be true.
Well, because everybody's talking about it. You're just like, I'm not the only one who feels that way.
Well, this is how, I mean, this is how things like Obama is a Muslim get spread around too.
Right.
The more you say it, Even when it's followed by evidence that shows it's not true, the more credence it gains. So there's nothing too idiotic to say that if it's repeated often enough, some people won't cling to it. In our case, a lot of people.
I think it's also very interesting that religion often accuse us of being just like them. I don't know if you've often heard this accusation saying, oh, well, you're just a faith-based religion just like us, which puts an interesting kind of perspective. One, do they think it's bad in the first place and undesirable? And if they do, what exactly do they think they see in non-belief that they perceive in their own belief? Like, what do you think is the element that they find is most common, like that they're absolutely convinced that we do?
Well, this is something one hears all the time. The reason why atheism is not a religion, as I first just cited, we don't have a pope or a body of doctrine. And the most common misconception of theists about atheists is this, that we say, I know there is no God. I can prove there is no God. No, we don't. You cannot prove negative. What the atheist says is simply, given all the evidence available to me or to anyone, I don't think there is a God. I can't prove that there is no God any more than a religious person can prove how the God they believe in came into being. It's a first cause argument which nobody can prove. But atheism is not a belief in the sense that religion is a belief, because what the religious person says is, I know this. What the atheist person says is, this is what I think on the basis of the facts in the observable world. From what we know about the observable world, this is what I think. The great 19th century orator Robert Ingersoll was asked this question in 1885 by a newspaper in Philadelphia. What's the difference between an atheist and agnostic? It was actually right after Thomas Henry Huxley invented the term agnostic for people who didn't, because atheist is a much older word than agnostic in the English language. In fact, lots of people like America's founders who weren't atheists but more unconventional deists and so on were called atheists when they actually weren't.
Well, I believe Thomas Jefferson was accused of that in one of the presidential races.
Oh, yeah, yes, of course. And Thomas Paine, a lot of them. But Ingersoll said there isn't any difference between an atheist and an agnostic. So the atheist is an agnostic and the agnostic is an atheist. The atheist just says, I don't think there is a God on the basis of the evidence available to me. But if you could prove to the atheist, you know, bring somebody back from the dead to tell you what it's like, maybe the atheist would change his mind.
I had a very similar conversation with my own sister, who had described herself as an agnostic. My sister's a very practical, sort of like to the point kind of girl. And I told her, I said, well, if you don't believe now, when do you think you will believe? it's probably not going to happen. You can remain open to it, but it certainly doesn't look like it's going that way.
Yes. Well, it's an interesting question, and I don't know the answer. Why religious people feel so, why deeply religious people, this again is a difference between people of moderate religion and fundamentalists. People of moderate religion don't care if you're an atheist. They don't try to argue you out of it either. Fundamentalist people feel deeply threatened by the existence of other ideas. It's one reason they hate liberal religious people almost as much as they hate atheists. The very existence of people who say, no, what you've based your entire life and expectations on isn't true, threatens them, you know, very profoundly. And I can't venture an explanation as to why this is so. If fundamentalists would stop mucking up the schools and trying to stop embryonic stem cell research and so on, I wouldn't think about them for 5 minutes. I think about them because they interfere in public life and with my rights in a way that is unacceptable in a civil society. But if they just went on believing the things they believe and didn't try to insert their beliefs into schools, I wouldn't give them a second thought. But they would give me a second thought.
Well, I think that...
And everybody at this convention.
Definitely, everybody at the convention would probably be looked at with a great deal of hatred and suspicion, probably, at the very least. So do you think ultimately the fact that, you know, people that are going to the conference or people that are getting more involved, you think atheists getting just much more involved in the political discourse, in trying to push back against junk thought and pseudoscience, do you think that this is really the solution to that, to the fact that we are kind of sliding towards irrationality? Do we need to push harder? Do people need to get more involved?
We need to push harder, and I think about this a lot. What does atheism mean in action? Well, first of all, it has to mean in action that people, whatever profession, you know, whatever state they have in life, start speaking out, and in a way, I mean, the great advantage that organized churches have over atheists is that they are organized churches. They have a permanent mechanism for passing on their values. I mean, I think, you know, for an atheist who is a parent, raising children without supernatural fantasies is very important. For atheists who have anything to do with schools as teachers or as parents, really, really putting themselves out there to fight these people, like the people who have overhauled the Christianized the curriculum in Texas, is very important. In the United States, this goes on everywhere, and it's something people really have to be on the front lines about. In terms of healthcare, we have, in the United States, we have a really, really enormous problem, which is that what the religious right wants to do is be able not merely not to perform health services of which they disapprove, which is fine. I don't see why somebody who personally considers abortion murder should have to perform an abortion.
No, obviously.
What shouldn't be allowed is that let's say when a girl is raped and goes to a hospital, she doesn't hear about the options of the morning after pill because she's gone to a hospital where the doctors and the administrators follow the doctrine of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So if I'm in healthcare, I have to, and I'm an atheist, or not even an atheist, just somebody who doesn't believe this, people really have to speak up at their own level. And I think one of the good things about what are called the new atheists is simply that talking about all this publicly, I think, does give courage to people who are not, you know, best-selling authors, let's say. It gives courage to people to speak up and at the level in which they can affect things, because this kind of irrational religiosity, it goes on in society from top to bottom. And I don't think we're getting there very fast, but I certainly think that we're farther along than we were 10 years ago, even though right now, at least American society, and I'm looking at some of the things that are going on in Europe, and I think in Europe too, the forces of anti-rationalism are really giving it a run for their money.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned being more active and so on and so forth. I had on one of my previous shows, I mentioned that I think one of the most important things for us to do, just even as human beings, is that the more we do, the more that there's a chance for people that can empathize with the things that we're trying to accomplish. Even though I'm relatively small in the atheist scene, I know that there are certain people that say, well, you inspired me to start my own podcast or to start my own blog. And I find it really is that simple. If a person decides what reason should I become involved, is that I don't think they're necessarily aware of the kind of reverberations that merely putting your voice out there and trying to get people to empathize with either your frustration at religion sort of trying to dictate people's lives, or even your fear if you're living in certain countries where your life is threatened. If you're
well, yeah, it's I mean, let's not put ourselves in the same position with poor dissidents in places like Afghanistan, women who just want to go to school. Those people are real heroes. And obviously, there's another thing which Atheism in Action can do, which is give financial support to these people. And one of the things that I do think atheists need to be more aware of, the fact is that all studies show that atheists don't give as much to, quote, charity, unquote, as religious believers do. Now, a lot of atheists have said this is deceptive because religious believers are giving to their church, which provides services. Well, there are a lot of services, and it doesn't have to be an atheist church. There are a lot of organizations that are doing work which is very related to atheist goals that atheists can give money to. And I do think that atheists need to put their money more where their mouth is. And also, it is important. I do believe that on causes which are dear to the hearts of atheists and free thinkers, that there are times when you want to cooperate with moderate religious institutions that have the same causes. Americans United for Separation of Church and State in America, for instance, whose executive director is actually a minister of the United Church of Christ, is doing huge and necessary work in all political seasons, fighting these constant attempts to intrude religion on government. These are organizations which also deserve the support of atheists.
So do we need an ecumenical agreement with the moderate religious people?
Oh, I don't think it needs to be that formal, but I never turn down an invitation to speak in a church. And I will tell you that one of the big problems, and this isn't just atheists, but one of the very bad things that the web has done, has a trend the web has greatly increased, is that everybody tends to talk only to people who think the way they do. Obviously, you can't get anywhere if you only talk to people who already agree with you.
I might already be accused of that, but to be fair, I am primarily an entertainer, so that's what I have to do.
Yeah, well, and people can be entertained, but when I get a chance, I always accept invitations from religious organizations. You know, I'll give you an example. The Freethinkers came out a long time ago. I was invited to speak at a university in north of Little Rock, really in the heart of the Bible Belt in Arkansas. And a lot of the, it was one of these things, you'll always have an audience because usually some professor assigns it, which I suppose the Texas Board of Education would call the liberal
settler
conspiracy at work. But I remember one of the first public lectures I ever gave, it was very well attended, and a lot of the kids had been raised in devout, you know, right-wing Baptist homes. Many of them were children of military families. And they would come up to me afterwards, and one of them would say, well, they would start out with, I'm a Christian, but. And Christian
oh
in America has a particular meaning. Nobody used to call themselves a Christian in America. When I was growing up, it was either I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Methodist, or I'm a Baptist, or I'm a Jew. But you didn't. Christian means a particular thing in America. It means right-wing Christian in those circles. So they would say, I'm a Christian, but. I believe in a woman should have a right to choose. I'm a Christian, but I believe that gays should be able to serve in the military. And, you know, what I would say to them is, look, I think first of all, you need to realize that Conway, Arkansas isn't the world, and that there are places where you could say, I am a Christian and. And so you might want to start thinking about that in terms of your own intellectual journey. In other words, I'm not interested in saying you should be an atheist to people like that. What I'm interested in when I talk to them is starting a conversation that gets them off of square one. They wouldn't be listening to me if they weren't moving off of square one. And I think that too is work that atheists have to do. That's how I see it.
Well, do you think that that there's a chance that perhaps the way that the religious right sells the idea that they might sort of say, well, atheists are the you know it's them or us kind of a thing, you know, like we believe in Jesus, we share already that in common, it has to be our common bond. Do you think we can kind of break their I don't want to say stranglehold, but you know they're holding up the Jesus stick around quite a bit, and to any Christian who doesn't support their own ideas, they'll pull it out often, and they seem to be more effective, at least in waving that stick, than the moderates themselves. I mean, where are the moderate voices that are coming as loudly? Like, can we do anything to even encourage those voices, or what should we do?
A lot of those voices actually are very loud. There is a big left wing religious communities in the United States, but you know part of the nature of not being a fundamentalist is you do tend to shout less loudly because nobody is as convinced as the right-wing fundamentalist that they're right. I mean, this is always a problem. It's always a problem in politics.
Right.
The people who are the most irrational are the people with the loudest voices, because part of rationality is sometimes you question your own beliefs.
It's almost self-defeating, though. We lose ground because we're trying to be intellectually honest with ourselves and with other people, and they're just more effective at being loud. What can we do? Is it almost like saying, well, we have to stop respecting loudness? it's a tough call.
That's a tough question to answer. And the answer on kind of a national stage is different from the answer on a personal stage. If I'm trying to overturn people who want to keep evolution out of the schools, like the people in Dover, Pennsylvania, most of whom opposed this were Christians, I don't call my fundamentalist opponent an idiot. I take it to court, which is what they did, and they won. So in other words, what you do on a micro scale and what you do on a larger scale is somewhat different. But that's true. That's true in every aspect of discourse. If you want to get somewhere, you know, to get somebody in a business to change what they're doing, you don't say you're a moron until you've already lost the battle, in which case there's no one.
Well, I guess you're taking that stance of, you know, the dickishness might not necessarily get us, you know, make any friends on the moderate religious side. And I think you're taking that stance that that's what we need to do a little bit more, maybe, that we need more people on our side that don't necessarily
but
believe
not
the same
all
thing.
Of us. I mean, there's a place, again, I say, atheism is not a church.
Yeah, no, definitely.
There is a huge place and very important role I mean, I think that, people like Dawkins and Sam Harris, they've been so important because they've basically put it all out there in a form that makes people really angry. That is valuable, too.
Well, you said that you, I think you mentioned before that that you're friends with Sam Harris, even though you disagree with him on, say, his principal thesis of the end of faith, that basically the moderates provide kind of like the
I don't agree with him about that, but I agree with everything else he has to say.
Well, I also think that that's kind of an interesting trait of free thinkers, where we can fundamentally disagree with certain people. Like, for instance, I know many atheists that would disagree with many of the points that, say, Hitchens believes in, his politics or what have you.
Sure.
But there's no one that's going to deny his kind of like his influence and his contribution to free thought and rationalism. And I think that in religious, in strongly religious circles, religious fundamental circles, they're probably not used to being able to get along with someone who still has different beliefs and ideas than they do. And we must seem alien to them to some degree, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, and you know, not all atheists necessarily respect each other's views, but much more than in this right wing religious community, because there are things that you just can't get around.
I had this hilarious conversation with these Jehovah Witnesses that had told me that, and they were trying to pretend that this was true, that everybody believed in exactly the same thing in their entire congregation, that there was no one who had any difference of belief. And you're just like, have you ever actually sat down and had a conversation, anybody?
Well, the closer you get to a cult, the more this is true, and people who do disagree eventually wind up leaving the cult. Listen, I think if we could wind this up with a final question.
There is one final question I wanted to ask.
I'm losing my voice.
And this is actually about your book, because you were talking about, say, the how video games, like there was a section in your book where you had mentioned how people weren't reading as much, and the internet was kind of providing a bit of a junk, I don't want to say education, but they kind of rely on other cognitive rewards that don't necessarily mean that a person will be educated. And I wanted to ask you if you thought that there was some merit in lots of the new research that's trying to incorporate the cognitive rewards of, say, games, and incorporate that in education. Like some schools experimenting perhaps with using experience points to reward students rather than necessarily grades.
Well, in fact, there is no research that shows that the use of video games in schools improves education at all. In fact, there are new studies out which are showing that there have been a lot of schools, huge amounts of money have been poured into supplying certain schools with video games. I found it stunning. And unfortunately, I haven't got time to search the web for this study. I'll try, and if I find it, I'll read. That the number of books in a home and how much kids read books still correlates almost entirely with achievement. There is absolutely no evidence that video games improves the educational or cognitive level of kids at all, except within the video game. And one thing we do know is that time is finite. There is one group of men between the ages of 24 are, of course, the most frequent users of video games.
Right.
The average man between the ages of 18 and 24 spends at least 3 hours a day playing video games. They also, something like 80% of men between the ages of 18 and 24 never read any book unless it's necessary for their work or school. There's also a direct relationship between how you use your time. One thing that the internet hasn't changed is we've only got 24 hours in a day. And any time you spend doing one thing, you can't spend doing another. I find myself, I have my own column at Washington Post on faith website, which is called The Spirited Atheist. And I'm just amazed when I look at some of the responses, which I do from time to time. I don't know how these people can possibly have lives. They seem to be blogging 24 hours a day. and blogging mostly again, with people who already agree with what they have to say, although occasionally people who want to say you're Antichrist come onto the thread too. But how these people can, they aren't getting a good night's sleep, because I've seen a lot of posts come in the middle of the night. You know, it might be great, like, for new parents who have to be up with crying
babies.
Right,
exactly.
And while they have to be up with the crying baby, they can blog a little and talk to another adult. But it's, there is a real problem with time. And now the studies are really coming out and they're real science. We know, for instance, that texting while driving greatly increases the rate of accidents. More disturbingly, we know, I was always under the impression that, for instance, kids who'd grown up with these devices would be better at it than older people. No. Kids who've grown up with these devices have the same accident rate as older people who do this. You cannot look down at a text message and be a good driver at the same time.
No, well, that's definitely true. So I guess the final and fundamental message of Susan Jacoby is read, everybody. Read a book. Read more books.
It is. And by the way, I have a new book coming out in February. And this actually might be a file coda to our talk about atheism in action. This is not a book about religion. It's a book called Never Say and Die, The Myth and the Marketing of the New Old Age. One of the things it says is, you know, if you live to be 90, you're going to be in pretty much the same shape as people who live to be 90, you know, for a long time. There isn't such thing as the new old age. But one of the chapters in the book discusses, you know, the whole controversy over assisted dying and death panels in the United States. Is living forever, is living as long as possible when you can't get better, is that a good thing? And does suffering have value? I mean, these are major questions for both atheism and religion. If you're going to die 6 months from now and you're of sound mind and you don't want to live out those 6 months, should you be made to live out those 6 months? These are questions in which atheism and religion have a profound impact on important issues in everyday lives. And I think that's another thing that atheists have to do, is not just talk about atheism on a large abstract scale. But the fact is people's beliefs, whether rational or not, have a big effect on things that we are all going to have to face. Like, for example, the question of whether longevity itself, greater longevity, is a wonderful ethical goal. Well, there are things that atheism, science, and religion have to say about that. And I'm interested in that in this new book. And I think more and more, I mean, the fact is atheism does impact education. It impacts healthcare. It impacts our attitudes about dying in old age. And I think we need to be talking about all that kind of thing, too. Not just, there again, religion has got all kinds of prescriptions for how people are supposed to live. We don't, but we certainly have things to say about what constitutes a decent life and a decent death.
Well, I look forward to reading what you have to say on that subject. I'm way too intrigued to not read your book, especially after the Age of American Unreason, which I also quite enjoyed. And it's been my great honor to interview you, and I really appreciate you giving me the time to do it.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope that this is of some use at the convention. I think people at this convention would be interested in this interview.
It's a great
interview, and I enjoyed doing. Did you deliberately clean out your language or something? I didn't hear any really bad language.
No, you know what the funny thing is? I was reading rereading some chapters of your book while I was doing it, and I have this habit of whenever I read an author, I start to think exactly like they do or use their own language. I don't know. I'm totally not used to it. This is still my third interview.
God, I wish everybody had that habit.
That's why I can't read Hitchens. If I read any Hitchens and I try to write, I'm writing bad Hitchens. That's what I end up doing.
Right. You got all these anglicisms creep into your. Well, I'll tell you a funny story about Canada. I mean, one of the reasons Canada is so different from the United States. The first time I was ever in Canada that wasn't Montreal or Toronto. It was years ago, I was married to a man who was the Canada correspondent of the Washington Post. And we went out to Calgary, and this is the 1970s. We went out to Calgary for Calgary Stampede.
Oh,
and there was a big, It was actually a lot of fun, but there was a lot of brouhaha in the town because they had a guy who was he'd set himself up as the Grand Kriegel of the Ku Klux Klan of Alberta.
Wow.
And so I decided, well, you know, I can do a piece for the Post on him, go interview him. He was a kind of crazy guy. His whole thing was Gaelic, returning to the ancient Gaelic of his ancestors.
And, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, all of these stern portraits of old Scotchmen and old Irishmen on his walls. But the Ku Klux Klans of Alberta, they were very non-racist because they already had an Indian clan and they wanted to create a black clan, the problem being there weren't very many blacks in Alberta at that point. But then he was trying to organize a demonstration at the Calgary City Hall, and the mayor had denied him a permit. And I said, so are you going to march anyway without the permit? He said, of course not. And I thought, you're not in America anymore, Susan.
Yep, that is quintessentially Canadian
This is a place where the Kriegel wouldn't dream of violating the mayor's orders.
we're nothing if, obeyers of even our own crazy and strange archaic laws.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Quebec itself is a great demonstration of the benefits to be had from a tamping down of religiosity. I mean, look at what Quebec was like when the Catholic Church had it in its grip, and look at what it's like now in comparison.
Well, the difference is so stark that 59% of Canadians believe in evolution, but 71% of Quebecers believe in evolution. That's a significant difference.
Yeah, but that is a lot more than the only 30% of Americans who believe in evolution.
Oh, I know, 39%. But, you know, at least you have the other half, another 39 practically, that says, I don't know. And maybe that's up to us to try to make sure that it turns from I don't know.
If you had taken that same Quebec poll 30 years ago, you'd get a lot worse results.
Yeah, for sure. No, definitely. Well, it's a shame that you're not going to be able to come down. It would have been great to actually meet you in person after such a.
Well, I've enjoyed doing this interview, and I hope that they can use it. Really, it's just as good as having me in person.
Well, I appreciate it.
It's an excellent interview, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, Susan, and I hope we'll speak again at some point, maybe when you write your – or if you're doing a book tour, maybe you can squeeze me in. I'd love to talk about it, especially after
I read it. Oh, sure. We can absolutely do that, and I'll make sure that they send a copy of my book. I'll give them your email address, and they can find out what your mail address is.
Well, now I'm in love. All right.
Okay. How old are you?
Well, I'm 30, so.
It's too young for me. Okay, well, what the hell.
All right, Susan, have yourself a good day.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Okay, bye.